Last time, as we looked at chapter 19, he was dealing mostly with issues of justice, how they were to carry justice out, what constituted justice, things like that. So he continues on. We're basically just picking up. The sermon continues from there. He changes the subject matter just a little bit. And so if you're there in chapter 20, okay, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just looking to make sure that I know what I'm talking about. All right, the numbers didn't line up here. I got it figured out now. Okay, chapter 20, let's start here, verse 1. Moses is talking to him, and he's telling him, when you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, don't be afraid of them. For the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. So it shall be when you're on the verge of battle that the priest shall approach and speak to the people, and he shall say to them, Hear, O Israel, today you're on the verge of battle with your enemies. Don't let your heart faint. Don't be afraid. Don't tremble or be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to save you. All right, we'll stop right there. Here Moses is telling them, God is telling them through Moses, giving them a command to trust God when they're facing their enemies, when they're ready to go into battle. You know, it could be easy to forget the fact that really, in relation to the other nations that are there in the land where they're heading, Israel is just a small nomadic group of people. Their army is relatively small compared to the other armies that they're going to be facing in the promised land, the places where they, you know, the people are there already. Now, it would be a very rare thing for Israel to ever go up against an army while they're undertaking this conquest, to go up against an army that's actually smaller than them, or an army that they've actually, you know, got the advantage on. They're always going to be facing superior numbers. And that's what Moses is saying here. That's what God is saying here, that they're always going to be dealing with superior numbers. They're going to be looking at superior technology. They're going to be looking at superior weapons. All of these things are the things that Israel is going to have to face over and over again. And that's the kind of stuff that makes any kind of experienced military guy, you know, want to fear. I mean, that's the exact stuff that military guys don't want to have to face. Superior numbers, superior technology, superior weapons, that's a terrible thing. And any normal guy is going to fear when he sees something like that. And so God's preempting that right away. God gets in there saying, don't fear. God's up front with Israel. And I love that about him. You know, he doesn't ever try to sugarcoat this or try to tell them something that isn't true. I mean, he doesn't say to them, it's going to be a cakewalk. These guys are nothing. You don't have to worry about it at all. No, he's really honest with them. He says, listen, you guys are going to be facing artillery and tanks and tons of infantry, and they're all going to be coming at you. But I don't want you to be afraid. That's just an amazing thing. I mean, you know, all the stuff that makes armies afraid is the very stuff that God points at and says, now, don't let that rattle you. Don't let that be something that makes you afraid. Now, if that's all that God had said, if all he said was, don't be afraid, that really wouldn't have been very much of a help to Israel. I mean, if all he said was, hey, don't be afraid, and, you know, this is a great phrase you can start using, you put it on little bracelets or bumper stickers, and you can go to Don't Be Afraid conferences, and it'll be awesome, and you guys will be having a great time. Well, it really wouldn't be much to that. There wouldn't be that much help involved in that. God goes on to explain to them why they shouldn't be afraid. God acknowledges that the forces that they're going to be facing are going to be greater than them. They're going to be superior to them in so many ways. But then God calls them to remember a greater fact, and that is that the Lord, their God, is with them. Such operative words are the most important thing involved in this. Don't be afraid. Why? Because I'm with you. There's nothing that's going to happen because I'm with you. I'm the one going in there. I'm the one commanding you to do this. There's nothing that they're going to be able to do. They're not going to be able to overcome you or defeat you in any way because I'm with you. And that's what God gets back. You know, and he points back to their deliverance from Egypt. You know, he calls them to remember that. You know, I'm the Lord, your God, who brought you up out of Egypt. He points back to something that happened in their history, something that they can remember, something they can look back at and say, that's right, God did do this. God did bring us this far. He did undertake on our behalf at that point. So we can trust him now, and he will undertake for us now as we face these new enemies. You know, that's one of the things that we need to do is as followers of God. Every once in a while, we got to look back and look at what the Lord has done for us in the past. Remind ourselves, shake ourselves, remember who we are, and remember, that's right, He's delivered me before. He's taken care of me. I can trust Him. He'll take care of me now. And that's what He's telling them there. And it's an old saying that the size of our fear is a good indicator to the size of our God. The amount of fear that we're going to give into, the amount that we're afraid of something, indicates to us, to our own hearts, exactly how big we think God is and how well we think He's going to be able to take care of a situation. You know, Paul reiterates this whole thing in Romans 8:31 when he says, if God be for us, who can be against us? In other words, you know, and he's trying to encourage the Roman church there. If God's with us, if God's on our side, we can't lose. How could anything go wrong for us in that sense? I mean, how could we ever be defeated? I don't mean go wrong for us circumstantially. All kinds of things go wrong for us. But on an eternal level, we cannot lose. On an eternal level, God has our back. There, you know, no matter what we face, no matter how difficult the trial may be, if God's with us, if God's for us, who could be against us? I mean, if God already, you know, Paul goes on there in Romans, and that's one of the things that he points out to the Roman church. You know, when he makes that statement, if God's on our side, how can we lose? And he goes on to explain, if God paid the ultimate price already by laying down His only Son to die for us in order to deliver us from sin, everything else after that is basic for God. I mean, why would He not go through and take care of us and preserve us and keep us safe in the process? Anything else that God would do for us after that is easy. So we obviously are going to trust that He's going to take care of us and deliver us and bring us through. There's no need to fear. So when they're on the verge of battle, and this is interesting to me, that when they're getting ready to go in and they're getting ready to fight a battle, the first guys that go up to them to talk to them, to give them a pep talk, is going to be the priests. God tells the priests to go in there, and I want the priests to go up and tell you, you know, exactly what's going on here and who you are and what you're supposed to be doing here. So the priest's calling is to encourage and to remind the troops that God's with them during this critical time. The priest wasn't going to go into battle himself. Numbers chapter 1, when it numbers all of the men who are fighting men, eliminates the priesthood out of that. The Levites don't go to battle. So the priests aren't going to be going into battle, but they do play a very crucial role here in going in and encouraging all the troops, letting them know, man, you're going to be okay. You don't fear, don't be afraid. God's with you, and God cares about you, and God's going to deliver you. And so it's a crucial role of encouragement to the soldiers. And, you know, if you think about this in a New Testament context, if you think about our role as believers and our role within the community of believers as the church, in a lot of ways, we fulfill both of these things as we live out our lives here together, as we experience life here together. We fulfill both of these roles. Nowadays, we are in a battle. It's not like what the children of Israel had to go through. It's not like what they faced. That was a theocracy. And so the children of Israel were going out and fighting literal battles against nations, and they were doing things along those lines. Now, since the dispensation of grace has come, now that we live in the salvation of Jesus Christ, things have actually become a lot clearer. The battle has become a lot clearer. Now we know that the battle is a clearly defined battle between the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of darkness. It's a battle that rages every day, and it rages from the moment we wake up. Actually, it's raging 24/7. It's raging all the time, even when we're asleep and when we wake up. And it rages through the circumstances that we face as believers, as those who are part of the kingdom of heaven, the things that we face and the issues that go on and the circumstances around us. There's a war being waged, and it's a battle between the forces of darkness and the kingdom of heaven. The values of the kingdom of heaven is what we represent. We represent those, and we live to see them established not only in our lives, but as best as we can to promote justice and the values of the kingdom of heaven within the sphere of our influence in this world. That's a battle that rages all the time. And as soldiers, as warriors, each one of us, we're facing that. Now, not everybody's battle is exactly the same. Some people are battling in circumstances over here. Some people are battling over there. Some people are feeling a little bit of a respite from the battle, have a breather for a moment, but they'll face a battle a little later on. But each one of us is going to be going through different battles in our different circumstances in life. Each one of us are warriors. But when we gather together here as the fellowship, as the church, as the community, we also get to play this role of the priest, of the royal priesthood, as Peter describes us, where we can go in there and encourage each other, where a person may be battling on a front where I'm not battling. And as a part of that royal priesthood, I'm not going to really be in that battle. Some battles that take place in our lives, battles like temptation to sin, those are struggles that we're going to be dealing with. It's just me, God, and the enemy. And nobody's going to be able to get in there and fight that battle for me. But what they can do, what any of us can do, is fulfill that role of the priest who comes up to encourage, saying, you're on the verge of battle here. You're on the verge of something crucial here in your life. And I'm encouraging you, brother. I'm encouraging you, sister, to remain strong in this. Don't be afraid of this. Don't let this battle define you. Don't let this enemy try to define you. Remember who you are. Remember who's with you. Remember who's battling with you. The Lord your God is with you. We can encourage each other along those lines. And in that way, we fulfill both roles. We're both warriors and priests as we gather as the church. It's kind of cool to me anyway. Anyway, verse 5, he goes on, then the officers shall speak to the people, saying, what man is there who's built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. And what man is there who has planted a vineyard and has not eaten of it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die and another man eat of it. And what man is there who's betrothed to a woman who's not married her? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in battle and another man marry her. The officers shall speak further to the people and say, what man is there who's fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return to his house, lest the heart of his brethren faint like his heart. And so it shall be, when the officers have finished speaking to the people, that they shall make captains of the armies to lead the people. Well, here is something really odd about God. I mean, when you think about it, this is something that he seems to do a lot. And we'll see him do this in a very famous way in Judges chapter 6 when he does this with Gideon. But this is God's unique way of securing victory by shrinking his army. And it's an odd thing. I mean, when you're discussing the logistics of battle and you're thinking about the things that you need to fight, you notice how God never prioritizes numbers when it comes to things like this. There is never a time where we're going to find God saying, gather up all the guys you can get. We need a lot of guys to be able to pull this one off, or anything like that. God never does that sort of thing. He never does. I mean, instead of General Patton walking out of there and standing up in front of the troops and saying, you know, I want every single one of you to fight, and I want all of you to do your part, and don't anybody slack off, and everybody get out there and do it. It's just the opposite. We've got generals. He's telling the generals to get up there and give a speech that excuses people from battle. Now, I want all of you guys who, how many here built a house? Oh, I did. Okay. You guys need to go on home because, you know, you don't want to die in battle and end up somebody else living in that house. And how many of you guys planted a vineyard? Oh, we planted a vineyard. Okay, well, did you get to eat any of the grapes? No, we didn't get any grapes. Oh, well, you guys go on home and eat grapes because you didn't get us. You don't want somebody else to eat those. I mean, that is an amazing thing to me. That's why we can never try to figure God out on a natural plane. When we start looking at the circumstances of life, we look at the battles that we face and the fights that we have to engage in, we just cannot sit down and try to logically think through how God is going to take care of this. God doesn't operate on those levels. God doesn't sit down and wring his hands and think, oh, how can we do this? What are we going to do? God is the hero. He pares everything down. He looks the situation over and goes, there's too many here. Let's shrink this down just a little bit so we can get some real victory going on here. That's an amazing thing to me. And he starts right off the bat, telling the Israelites, you know, you're going to face times where you're going to be outnumbered. I mean, a lot of soldiers out there, and they're going to have the big guns, and everything's going to be pouring in right at you. And, you know, he's reminding of that at the first level. And then he says, and when the generals get up there, make sure that they excuse all of those people that fit the criteria of those who don't have to fight. I mean, that's just amazing to me. You know, all these guys with unfinished business, you guys go on home. You got a best girl at home? Did you get a marrier? No. Oh, go on. Go home. Hey, you guys have a good time. We're just going to fight this battle over here. That's all. That's incredible to me when you think about this. I mean, Wouldn't Dale have enjoyed that back in Vietnam? His wife was pregnant with their first child. They never said to him, "Hey, Dale, why don't you go on home, buddy? Don't worry about this. We'll take care of this for you." There was no such thing. No rational army does this kind of stuff. This is bizarre behavior. I mean, we gotta face facts on that. You hang out with God long enough, you're gonna do weird stuff like this. This is off the wall. I mean, God tells them to you know, just take off. And then he says, if you're afraid. Well, I don't know. I can't imagine anybody is not afraid. You're looking at bigger armies and bigger guys and the whole thing. Who's afraid here? Well, you know, and so all these hands raise up. And he says, okay, you guys go on home too. Because we really don't want you to hang out if you're afraid. You're going to make everybody else afraid. So you guys go home too. And the rest of us, we'll just take care of this. I mean, I just think that's amazing. I mean, God's recipe for victory is definitely not man's recipe for victory. God does things according to his plans and his purposes and his ways. God's plans include his power and seem to exclude our resources altogether. And I think that's fascinating. I mean, there's so many ways and so many times in my life where when I'm facing a crisis, I'm facing a difficult time, I'm looking at the circumstances and everything's bigger than me. I mean, I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, I can't do this. I need more. I need more resources. I need all of these. I could do a lot of things if I had some money, you know, or whatever. And God's recipe for victory has nothing to do with all of those things that I sit down and try to work up on my own. What God does is he waits for me to hand the reins over to him. And put my trust in him and come to the realization that if God is with me, then who could possibly be against me? And when I come to that realization that God's the one who's going to bring this victory into my life, that God's going to be the one who does this, then it really doesn't matter what resources I have or what kind of things I can cobble together. It's all about what he does and what he's purchased for me already, what he's provided. That's just the way he does things. God's perfectly willing to use those guys who are left. After all of these excuses, I mean, I can't imagine, you know, especially the house one and the vineyard one. I mean, that's a big deal. That's what they're going there to the promised land to do, to build houses and to plant vineyards and stuff. You can imagine that at least in the initial stages of this, there's going to be a lot of guys who are going to say, yeah, I haven't gotten to live in my house yet. I didn't get to eat out of the vineyard yet. And yet God's perfectly willing to use the leftovers after all of these others are excused. He's perfectly willing to use, excuse me, what small company is left there? I wonder if that made it on tape. And anyway, you know, you just get on a roll and you're breathing in big gulps of air trying to keep up with everything, and all of a sudden one of them just escapes. And you can't help it. You got to be a public speaker to understand what that's like. Anyway, so that's what God does. God pares everything down to its minimal amount in order to bring about his best victory. Those who were left were going to have to trust God. And see, that has a dual purpose. God gets the greater glory, but those guys who are left, they're definitely going to have to be trusting in God. They're definitely going to have to be keeping their eyes on the Lord. They're watching all their friends leave. Okay, you know, we're going to go do this. We're going to take on superior numbers with less guys than the way we started. And I think that's amazing. To God, the size of the army just is never important. And really what the message that comes across in that then is that if it's not the size of the army that's important, then it's the heart of the army that God seems to be concerned about. He doesn't want people there who are there just because they have to be there. Because once you've paired all these other guys out, that's what you're left with. Guys who are just there because they want to be there. They want to be with God. They want to do what he's doing. This is just a big adventure, and they're going to see what he does and how he pulls it off. He's not interested in having people there by constraint. There's no draft involved in this. I mean, you know, well, that's not accurate. I mean, there was kind of a draft in the sense that every man at a certain age was supposed to be fighting for the military anyway. So, you know, I suppose that's semantics. But the idea is that God didn't want people there by constraint. He wasn't interested in filling up an army of people who were there because it was their, you know, their obligation. They just had to be there. They wanted guys who were there because their loyalty to God was such that they were just going to follow his commands and fight his battles and be a part of whatever he was doing. And we find that over and over again in the record of this, and especially in the great example of it in Judges chapter 6, where Gideon pairs this army down to 300 men, God is able to pull off greater victories with smaller amounts of men that are really committed to him than with a bigger army of people who are just there because they're there by constraint. You know, it's one of those things. I just wish the church would learn lessons from this. We get so caught up in numbers and making sure, and it's mostly an American culture thing, but, you know, this whole idea that we got to have it big, it's got to be bigger and better and wealthier and powerful and all this stuff. And where in the world do we ever find that in the Bible? We never find that kind of attitude coming from God. God doesn't care about numbers. God doesn't care. He doesn't have to have gigantic amounts. I mean, he cares about souls. And he wants people coming into the kingdom of heaven. But in terms of being able to accomplish something or represent his kingdom, man, he can do that with a handful of people just as easily as he can do that with thousands, and probably more effectively through a handful of people at any given gathering. You know, it's just a misplaced priority to me whenever we see the church running around, you know, compelling people to bring in visitors or get bigger numbers or compelling people to give money or compelling people to do whatever, to work in the church or anything. We need to let God bring the victory. We need to let God provide the impetus within our own hearts so that we got a willing community that's serving because we want to serve, not because we've been guilted into it or been forced into it in some way. That's the priority that God chose. God always reveals that. He wants willing servants. He doesn't want people who've been guilted into doing stuff. All right, verse 10. When you go near a city to fight against it, then proclaim an offer of peace to it. And it shall be that if they accept your offer of peace and open to you, then all the people who are found in it shall be placed under tribute to you and serve you. Now, if the city will not make peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. And when the Lord your God delivers it into your hands, you shall strike every male in it with the edge of the sword. But the women and the little ones and livestock and all that's in the city, all its spoil, you shall plunder for yourself, and you shall eat the enemy's plunder which the Lord your God gives you. Thus you shall do to all the cities which are very far from you, which are not the cities of these nations. These nations, talking about the nations of Canaan. So here God's giving instructions about how to go about executing a war and the principles for battle. And note that the first thing that they're supposed to do, if they're fighting with a city who's outside of the boundaries of where the promised land is, that they're first supposed to offer peace. God didn't want Israel fighting unnecessarily. He didn't want them to fight a battle if they didn't have to. And if the city was willing to accept the terms and willing to surrender, then they'd just become a tributary of Israel. That is, they'd pay Israel taxes, and that was just one of those things. They'd be basically brought into the fold of Israel to that degree, and they would use them as that. But he says if they're not going to offer, you know, if they're not going to accept an offer of peace, then they're supposed to besiege the city. And that, to besiege the city, means basically they're going to surround the city with their armies, and they're going to cut it off from the outside world altogether so that no supplies are getting in, nothing's getting out, and no messengers are getting in or getting out or anything like that. And that's the idea. It's a battle of attrition at that point. You're basically holding them in place and waiting until they're weakened. When their food supplies begin to run down and their water supplies begin to get polluted and they get weaker and weaker until you finally either storm the place, storm the walls, or they surrender because of hunger. And typically, these kind of things, typically a siege is something that would take place over a period of years. This didn't just happen. You know, it wasn't like, you know, we went to war against Iraq and, what was it, 13 days or something like that to Baghdad? I mean, it was hardly anything. I mean, and it was over. It wasn't like that at all in those days. This, you know, to lay siege to a walled city, that was something that you were in for the long haul. They had to commit to it and they had to And they had to cut it off and cut off the resources to it. And then God commands them to kill the men, but to leave the women and the children and to take the spoils of the city as plunder. This is for cities outside of the realm of the promised land area. Those are cities that if the threat comes to them or whatever, they're going to have to go out and face that. And this is the way they're supposed to deal with it. So he goes on, verse 16, but of the cities of these peoples, talking about the Canaanites, which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, you shall let nothing that breathes remain alive, but you shall utterly destroy them. The Hittite, the Amorite, all those ites that are living in there, just as the Lord your God has commanded you, lest they teach you to do according to all their abominations, which they've done for their gods, and you sin against the Lord your God. All right, so here's something interesting that none of this applied to the Canaanites. I mean, none of the above, none of the stuff that he's talking about in terms of, you know, you can kill all the males, but leave the women and the children alive and the animals. But in this place, he's saying, wipe them out. I want you to wipe them out, all of them. I want you to take them all out. There's no peace. There's no plunder. There is no survivors. This is really intense. This is beyond just conquest, and this is beyond defense. This is talking about obliteration. This is what God's calling them to do. And he seems to indicate there that this is because their culture is so corrupt that he doesn't want the danger of infection to linger. He doesn't want it to infect the Israelite culture to the least degree. And so they are commanded to annihilate them. Do they do this? Do they fulfill this? They do not. They don't. And so what happens is Israel throughout its history is plagued by this very infection that God was warning them about. As a matter of fact, by the time that the Babylonian invasion comes, the infection is so great that they've polluted the temple. They've done all kinds of terrible things. The priests are living in a dual role of being pagan idolaters on the side while putting on a show of being Israelite priests, and on and on and on. I mean, so they didn't fulfill what God told them to do. God told them to utterly annihilate that. Now, when we look at that, and you know, we view this through the lens of New Testament Christianity, this really seems harsh. I mean, we look at this, and this just like, man, you know, are we talking about, this is the same God, right? I mean, it's the guy that loves us and his grace and all of that, and yeah, it is. But it doesn't negate the fact that God is also just, as well as being merciful, as well as being loving. God is also just, and his justice does require that it be expressed. Some people's judgment precedes them into the day of judgment, and some people's comes after. And in the case of nations, God is in the practice of judging the nations. He has been in the past. He is in this present day. I still believe he is sovereign to that degree. He judges the nations. He still sits as the judge of nations. Just as God judged the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, just as he judged Babylon later on, just as he judged Greece later on, just as he judged Rome later on, just as he judged Germany later on, just as I believe one day we as America will face his judgment. One day, that's the way God works. God judged the land of Canaan because of their idolatry, because of what they were doing. And he used Israel as his sword. Israel was his sword to go through and execute his judgment against the atrocities on a religious level and on a genocidal level or an infanticidal level, because of their practices of the Molech worship. They were murdering children left and right. Their children were being forced to pass through the fire. What that meant was, is they had this giant idol that in its belly had a huge furnace that they would stoke up to a great heat, and they'd throw their children into it. I mean, these are horrific acts that these people were committing under the auspices of religiosity. And so God judged them, and he used Israel to do that. Israel was the executor of that judgment. And Israel then became the inheritors of the land that these people at that time had possessed. It may seem harsh, but God still does that. God still uses nations to attack other nations to bring about his judgment, I believe. You can't look at some of the events of world history and not see that. You can't look at the events of World War II and not see that God was using nations to accomplish his will. I believe he uses our nation right now to accomplish his will, but it doesn't negate the fact that I also believe one day we're going to be on the receiving end of that. We can't continue on violating God's ways and God's will. We can't continue on murdering the unborn and doing all the things that we do as a culture and putting the stamp of approval on it and expect that one day God is not going to judge that, just as he judged the Canaanites and on and on and on. I just believe firmly that that's going to happen. I mean, I believe this nation is a wonderful place, and I'm grateful for the freedoms that I have here. I'm grateful for all that God's provided, but I don't believe this is the kingdom of God. This is the United States of America. Kingdom of God is far transcending this nation, and this nation has a lot to answer for in a lot of ways. As much as I love this country, I'm not going to be absurd in my loyalty to it. My loyalties go to the kingdom of heaven. And one day, we're going to have to answer for these things. I pray for us. I pray for our leaders. I pray for God's extended mercy to us. But, history leans against us. We're an anomaly in world history. There's never been anything like this nation. There's never been anything like this nation. And the history of the world leans against us in our survival. But anyway, verse 19, he says, when you besiege a city for a long time, see there he's talking about, it's going to take a while making war against it to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. If you can eat of them, don't cut them down to use it in a siege, for the tree of the field is man's food. Only the trees which you know are not trees for food you may destroy and cut down, to build siege works against the city that makes war with you until it's subdued. So here he actually even throws in a few environmental issues. And how cool is this? Save the trees, God says. You know, fight this war, kill the people, but watch out for the trees. But what he's saying in that, he's not trying to prioritize trees over people, but what he's saying in that is that don't do this. Don't carry out your war or execute your plans in such a way that you are destroying the natural resources that you're going to need later on for food. Use a little thought in this whole process. You know, think ahead. Keep the trees that bear fruit, because that's the food that you're going to need to eat. And then, of course, God's forecasting victory for them even in this, because he's indicating you're going to need to eat something somewhere along the line, which means you're going to have won and you're going to be the owners of this property. So make sure that you're cautious with what you do, which is a good principle. I mean, the immediate need for wood ends up being less important in the long term than the good of the resources, the good of the area. I mean, that's a good lesson to learn in life all the way around, that no matter how urgent the situation is, to trust the Lord for the wisdom and the peace of mind to understand how things are going to work in their long-term ramifications. How is this going to affect things later on? And that's what God's trying to warn them there, to be cautious of the land that they have, because they want it to be fruitful later on, which is a good principle. I mean, you could take that and just take the general principle. You couldn't make a direct application, but the general principle of it is, man, you know, we may get into a disagreement with someone within the fellowship or someone that we work with or someone all the way around the line and find ourselves in some kind of a debate or a conflict or something. We have to be careful. We have to think ahead as we deal with something like that. Make sure that we're not destroying the whole land. Make sure we're not just tearing it all apart so that it can't be useful later on, because who knows what the Lord wants to do with each and every individual. And so we got to be careful and cautious how we deal with things, which is a good principle to keep in mind. So Father, we just thank you for your word. We thank you for instructing us through it. Lord, all the amazing ways in which you revealed your wisdom and your power and your glory in these instructions to the Israelites. And I just pray that we're comforted by it. We take heed that and remember that we belong to you, that you fight our battles for us, and that with you on our side, there's nothing that we have to fear. I pray that becomes a reality in our lives as we live out our lives and face the circumstances we face. And I pray this, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Any questions or comments?